I'm about to meet the current CEO of Innovate UK. And the reason why I am so thrilled to be able to talk to him is because I saw him speak at a Royal Academy of Engineering event just a couple of weeks ago. It was a diversity event, and he was talking about the importance of empathy and consciousness and all these human traits that we don't tend to associate with innovation.
You've tuned in to Innovators Making a Difference, a podcast series where I meet daring disruptors, tenacious trailblazers, and persistent pioneers who are solving some of the globe's trickiest challenges using science, technology, engineering, and innovation.
Hi, Indro.
Hi, Shuni.
Great to see you there. Thank you for joining me. Now, I was just giving an introduction. I didn't tell our audience much about your background, but I was telling them about how I was really struck with your speech that you gave at the Royal Academy of Engineering and the humanness, the traits of empathy and consciousness and connection and care that you spoke so passionately about when it comes to innovation. So I'm throwing you in the deep end here to give us an introduction to yourself and why innovation is important to you.
Well, to be honest with you, Shuni, I feel quite a lot of my life and certainly my career has been to be thrown into the deep end. So that's quite a common feeling for me. I guess by way of brief personal introduction, I'm British born, first generation, Indian father, Italian mother, born and raised in London, actually inner London, in a time where the world and certainly the UK was quite a different place than it is today. Along my life, I've seen the very, very best of this nation and people, and occasionally I've also seen stuff that's maybe not at the very best as well. By way of the sort of more career things, I'm by background a business guy. I've led businesses, tech businesses, that have been large ones with thousands of people, medium-sized ones with hundreds, but also small businesses with tens of people. So I've seen the innovation journey across those very different settings in those areas. And now, leading Innovate UK, our national innovation agency.
Why is innovation so important for not just the UK, but just generally?
Well, first of all, we should just acknowledge that innovation is one of these words that is used in many, many different ways. It can mean many different things to different people. It's important from my perspective because it exemplifies things like progress, creativity, problem solving, taking next steps, and translation of science and ideas into economic and business reality. So those are the things that I think of when I look at that word. Beyond that, there are also other things that come to mind, which include words like, I guess, hope, aspiration, chance for greater fairness, opportunity to make people better, to improve health, to make people happier, stuff like that. So it's a very broad connotation of different areas.
Yeah, I think we use the word a lot, regardless of which discipline you're in. I think innovation is used a huge amount. And as a result of it being used for everything from art to food to, I mean, it's just all over the place, that I think it tends to dilute the importance of innovation from a STEM perspective. I think we share a common passion for the advancement of technology and the impact that advanced technologies can have on our well-being. You know, what are we lacking to be stronger when it comes to innovation, particularly from a STEM perspective?
I think we could be stronger by being more joined up across our systems. The UK has got an incredible ecosystem of passionate, capable, brilliant people, brilliant innovators, brilliant scientists, brilliant business people who could make a big difference. we see sometimes that our system is also quite disparate and quite disaggregated, and so pulling things together and making connections and making pathways, I think, is a very important element. And beyond that, from a STEM perspective as well, the issue of the understanding that we do have a skills gap, and we need to work hard and be conscious that we do have that skills gap, and we need to work hard to bridge the skills gap. The irony is that the greater the success in terms of driving an innovation-based economy, the greater the skills gap becomes, because you need more people to be able to populate the successful businesses, to do what they need to do, etc. And also keeping in mind that innovation means that skills needs evolve. And so as you go through technology changes, you have needs for new skills. We have a substantial life sciences industry in the UK, as an example, and many of those skills are skills that are very, very new, because a lot of the technology is relatively new. Same for AI, same for quantum, and same for any other areas. And so I think those would be the two things I would suggest: joining up the system and the issue of skills.
Yeah, I agree with you. The other day I came across the Global Innovation Index, purely because I put innovation into Google, and actually I was using ChatGPT to find out how we measure innovation, because innovation, when you Google innovation, so many pages come up, and it is a very general term. And so the Global Innovation Index came up, and I was so pleasantly surprised to see that the UK has been consistently fourth in the world, which is fantastic news. I was really encouraged by that, because I think I've been very consumed with a lack of STEM skills in the UK, particularly when you compare it to the fact that, you know, we were leaders in the Industrial Revolution, and less young people are tending to choose STEM subjects because they're perceived to be really scary subjects. How do we resolve this idea that we are fourth in the world when it comes to innovation, yet we also have a skills gap?
We resolve it by accepting that both points can be true, and that we accept that problem solving is about understanding how to make solutions based on blended inputs. Sometimes these days we are polarizing, it's got to be one or the other. So it's actually both. Yes, we are fourth in the world, and yes, we've got there really is a fantastic innovation ecosystem and pedigree here in the UK. I spend my working time being privileged to be part of that. But at the same time, there is also a skills gap, which is there because, paradoxically, as we build up that innovation power, we have more need for more skilled people. And so both are true, and so both are there to be dealt with. And I think if we as leaders can look at this on a system basis, so don't just try and solve the problem by looking at one part of it, look at it on a system basis. If we look at the UK as a system, which includes everything from schools, colleges, universities, businesses, researchers, every aspect of it, you will find that actually it helps, because I think we do have the need to build up our skills base in these new areas, and as our innovation economy progresses, that will increase. As an example, and I can talk more about this if it's of interest, in Innovate UK, we do a lot of skills foresighting. So we look at technology trends and industries which are sometimes even very nascent, and project how they could develop. And from that, you can get a sense of the kind of skills needs that you would need for that. And there are examples recently, like in areas of clinical research, where a lot of businesses that have been growing need clinical research techniques in areas like life sciences. And it'll be the same in many other areas as well. So these are examples of ways that we look forward.
What other skills do we need? Because I come from an engineering bias. How are we doing, for example, when it comes to engineering?
On engineering, we have a very good base in the UK, that's for sure. We've got some great academic centres. We've got a great network. even beyond universities. I was at UTC Leeds yesterday, and it was great to see how that institute has arranged its essentially a kind of technology school, a STEM school, to prepare young people to become early career people in technology. And so it's a very broad system. So we have some really good elements in terms of that. I think the areas where we could look to develop are areas to do with the packaging of technology into the creation of businesses. So for example, marketing, selling, value proposition. How do you make a pitch to raise money? How do you convince a customer that something is a good thing to commit to? How do you motivate people? How do you build a business? And it's these commercial skills, or let's say more general skills, that you need to create businesses. I think these are some of the attention points for us.
Yeah, I think you hone in on a point that is very close to my own heart, because I've spent many years feeling really bad going from, you know, deep research in engineering to then a career in media. But I just felt that it was so important for an engineer to be able to communicate. And now I'm more convinced than ever that we need to train our engineers to be able to communicate and have a forward, like, public-facing persona.
Yeah, one of the things I'm known for is the repetition of, please tell me, please condense it down to some clear messages, like three messages or something like that. I think we could all improve in that regard, and it's something very important. So sometimes the people with the greatest passion and the greatest knowledge of something might sometimes be people who needed some help in terms of being able to package that message in a way that somebody else can more readily understand it. And this, of course, is a basic commercial thing that's needed in any commercial setting. And so there are many examples, by the way, of great engineers, great scientists who do make that transition and make it very well. The UK has got many of those examples, and we're very blessed with those people. And so as a nation, we'd like to see more of those examples, and it becomes more prevalent to be able to articulate clear and compelling messages.
That's definitely an area where there could be more development in the crossover between engineering and business, perhaps in the form of engineering degrees meeting business degrees, for example. On my travels in doing what I do, there has been a real disconnect in the educational system, I feel, between arts and science. And actually, that's where I think innovation lies, which is that sort of grey area of the Venn diagram.
You have many great businesses, many great innovations that have happened from arts and social sciences. Absolutely, there's no question about that. And we have a very vibrant and very important creative industries sector in the UK that epitomises that. So this is very much, there's fundamentally no difference to a path for innovation between something from a physical science to something from a social science or from an arts or humanities area. These are all tracks that you can get to innovative solutions, and all tracks that you can get to innovative solutions which are relevant to our economy. So we very much see that combination of all of those different areas being relevant.
Do you think, in order to increase the level of innovation, we need to have a slight shift in attitude?
When you said the word attitude, the first area I thought of was to do with risk taking and consequences. That was the first area that I thought. I'm sure there could be others as well. It's always bad when you grossly generalise, because of course individuals are individuals, and so generalisations never quite work because there's always exceptions. But if you were to make something that is sometimes accepted as a preconceived generalisation, there is this notion that risk taking in, say, for example, the States, is something that's done on a more prevalent basis than it is, for example, in the UK. This is one of these generally accepted generalizations. Of course, there are many people who disprove that, but if we just go with it just for a second. So then, as part of that, you look at the attitude to failure, or how failure is defined. One of the things that is important is your management of money, management of trust, management of opportunity. And if you try something and it fails, is it something that is bad, and therefore you've gone against the trust and the fiduciary responsibilities that you had? Or is it just a consequence that you gave something a go and stuff is hard? It's not easy. And this is a kind of grey area, and it is a cultural thing, and it is a cultural thing that we are adapting to. So I don't think it's right to have a culture where you just say there's no worry, I can do anything, no consequence, because a society like that wouldn't be a very good society. But at the same time, if you don't have an acknowledgement that you have to have some risk taking, then you're never going to make any progress. I think that would be the area I would suggest.
I mean, that's a mic drop moment, because it's funny, this podcast is called Innovators Making a Difference, and the very first episode last month of this series was by a curator of the Museum of Failure. And so we discussed failure at length, and I have a feeling that every episode of this series is going to touch on the subject of failure, because it can be such a block to innovation. The fear of it can be a block, the avoidance of it, you know, all these things that prevent us from experimenting and trying something new and thinking laterally, because we don't want to waste time and money. Can innovation happen without the investment of time and money? Is it even possible?
No. You are investing time, money, energy. You're investing hope. You're investing nights when you haven't slept. You're investing traveling great distances. You're investing overcoming barriers that would otherwise you would have stuck within. You're investing taking steps that may take a huge act of courage for you to do. All these things have been invested when you try. And when you do those things, the consequence of doing that is not always a Hollywood movie and it's all wonderful. Sometimes it isn't. All of us look at something going wrong or going not the way we wanted to in a different way. And it's part of just learning, being a grown-up, being a human being, to learn that people don't all react to that in the same way. I've seen different people internalize and externalize things that haven't quite gone the way they wanted to in different ways, and you grow a lot of respect for human beings and how they go through their own journeys of those things.
In the same way that I was struck when I heard your speech at the Royal Academy of Engineering event, I was really struck by your consideration for the human side of what you do. And I'm hearing it again, actually, which is that, you know, whether you're leading thousands of people in a company, there is a real empathy for leading innovation. Because it does come with the grey areas and the failures and the challenges of not getting the answer right. Are you able to describe what it takes for you to personally lead? What are the qualities about you that you really draw on to do your job?
I just know that people are at their best when they feel happy and clear and respected and acknowledged. And sometimes being at your best is super important, because things can be challenging, and so you want people to be at their best in that. And I know that people are not at their best when they don't, because I'm not. So I can't say it to you in any smart way, because I don't have that vocabulary, I'm not an expert, but just from a feeling point of view, it's that, and also belonging. So I know what has felt like to me at various points in my life where you just don't feel that you are part of something, or you know what you feel like. So therefore, it should be a leader's role, but actually it should be anyone's role, as a matter of fact, not just a leader, but particularly a leader, because leaders lead people, to try and help people to feel that they belong to something. You're important. I respect you, and you have your role. We used the word failure earlier because that's an understandable word to use when you try something, it doesn't go, you try and develop a product, it doesn't work, etc., etc. That's a normal word to use. Sometimes failure can be a very particularly emotive word, and it might not be the best word to use because there are other words that you can use, like mistakes, or it could just be an outcome. So sometimes you say something to somebody, and it's obvious you said it in the wrong way because you can see the reaction that's come back. So you think, oh, I need to do a better job there. I need to learn. I need to say something better. So ultimately, this is about this calibration. I don't think any of us can ever get these things 100% right. But the clock starts ticking when you get it wrong, and how keen are you to try and resolve that you got it wrong and to try and do something about it?
Because I am someone who worked incredibly hard to get my engineering qualifications, but then felt like I didn't belong because back then, we're talking like 2 decades ago, the engineering industry was a very homogenous group of people that I looked nothing like. And it motivated me to try and encourage more diversity and inclusion into engineering. And, you know, I'm happy to say that 20 years later, we have a much more diverse and inclusive industry now. That's not to say that we don't have further to go, but, you know, we're making good progress.
Yeah.
I'm just extremely hopeful in hearing you that you recognize the importance of people feeling like they can belong, because it's not just enough to be technically excellent at something. It's also important for innovation to have that technical excellence be nurtured. And I think that's where we are today, which is that, you know, we see many movements that is recognizing the importance of inclusion. And we tick boxes to have a more inclusive workforce. I'm not going to comment on how we're doing on that, but there's certainly a recognition that we need more diversity in order to have better innovation. But I think we're at a point where we now need to do more to keep those diverse groups going.
I mean, at the end of the day, we employ individuals. We employ people. We work with people. We serve people. They are individuals, and it's impossible to have a full, complete kind of DNA understanding of everybody, because sometimes we don't even understand ourselves fully, and we have that.
Yeah.
What we need to do is to work out how we can respect, acknowledge, and make people feel that they can be at their best. I sometimes use the phrase, we all have our own shoes. And the reason I say that is because there's this expression sometimes to be in somebody else's shoes.
Mm.
So I don't know whether you know exactly what it's like to be in my shoes. And I don't think I know what it's like to be in your shoes. We've had different lives. However much I tell you about my life, you will never know about as much about my life as what I know about it, and I won't know about your life as much as you know about it. But what I can do is to ask you how you feel, and then make that to be the basis of how we would work together.
That's so powerful, and I think it's a very subtle difference that can often go unrecognized. This idea of not trying to be in the other person's shoes, but to acknowledge that they have their own shoes and to let them walk in their shoes. And it does require trust, because often allowing someone to walk in their shoes says go. You know, you're saying go, walk in your shoes, make your mistakes, it's okay. And, you know, just to rein it back, because I think it's important for innovation to have that attitude, because innovation does require so much experimentation, trying things out, being daring, having the courage. If someone's tuning in and they're hearing, you know, us talking about feelings, it could be like, you know, what on earth is going on in this conversation? But it is so crucial to allowing for innovation to happen.
It's crucial for innovation to happen, but it's crucial in any kind of leadership role. People don't work at their best when they're not at peace and happy. And just to be quite clear, all human beings will make mistakes at some time or other. So you have to understand, at the end of the day, all of us, we're not robots. All of us are individuals. We have feelings about one thing or another. But if a leader is not aware of the feelings of people, then I'm not quite sure what kind of results you're going to get.
It reminds me of, it's not a failure if you learn from it, that saying. I don't know who said it. Thank you for talking about these topics, because it gives permission for these topics to be discussed, and I do think they are crucial as discussion points when it comes to innovation. What else are barriers for these kinds of people who are underrepresented?
There are many barriers, and that's why there are many lenses for diversity and inclusion. They could range from barriers that we can see to barriers that we have no idea that they're there, but they are there. The list is very, very significant. It will range from everything from perhaps demographics, socioeconomic issues. It could be issues to do with disability. There could be, there could be many, many lenses that you could look at things. And so, you know, as an economy, we need innovators, we need successful innovators, we need businesses that are based on innovation. And so we need the people to be able to start those businesses, work in those businesses, contribute to those businesses. And so we need to encourage the broader set of people to be able to feel that they would have careers and be welcome in those areas. And so we have to overcome them. I mean, I'll give you an example of something that sometimes people don't talk very much about. We ran a number of events where we would look at our own processes as Innovate UK from the perspective of innovators who identify themselves as having a disability. And, you know, disabilities are sometimes things that are seen and visible to others, and sometimes they're not. Understand it from their perspective. Look at our systems. Look at what it's like to make an application for a grant, for example. Look at what it's like to go through some of our systems. Look at what it's like to get feedback. It's like going back into junior school, because you have to learn. You just have to look at the reality of what you do from the perspective of somebody else. And so this is how you break down barriers, you make things more inclusive, and then you build a greater innovation-based economy, because we want to have the best and the brightest from everywhere to be able to be part of this innovation economy. You don't click a finger or have a meeting and then it's all solved. These things take time. It needs to have intent. But the first part of it is to be open to understand that you have to break down barriers from the individual's perspective, not break a barrier down because you think you've broken a barrier down, and tell somebody you should be happy now because I've broken down this barrier. Well, maybe you don't think that, and so ultimately we want that. But as an innovation agency, we are very, really very keen for the best, the brightest to contribute to our nation's economy through tech success, and so this is why these things are very important.
If there's one major thing that I take away from this conversation, and there are many things, but the one major thing for me is you've reinforced this idea that it's really important to develop oneself in order to contribute to the world of innovation. And that's so key. We live in a world that's extremely noisy with externalities, but developing one's inner drive to make a difference through innovation, I think, is number one.
We have so much going for us as a nation, and we have so many talented people, and so ultimately it's about making the best use of our talent. My job as a public servant is to help our economy, and so it makes economic sense. It's just the right thing to do, because if you could liberate people's confidence, give them a chance, and then they go for it. One of the greatest privileges of my job is to be able to travel all over the country and meet exactly these people who are all types of people. There's no stereotype for this. There's all types of people who have given this a go. They've either started something for themselves, or they've taken something from this level and made it bigger, or they've tried something new, or they've joined something, and this is our innovation economy. And I think there are some great, great examples of this. And so I'd very much like to see this become one of the exciting things, especially for early career people to aspire to, because I think the more we have in that, the better it is for all of us. It's an economy based on high productivity, tech-based businesses is a strong economy, and is one that ultimately benefits all of us.
Indra, I don't think there's anything more that needs to be said. That was so powerful, and I want to hold on to that final sentiment, because I think that is absolutely crucial for the future of innovation. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been amazing to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Shirley. Nice to see you.
Well, I don't know about you, but I had goosebumps talking to Indra there, because there we have a person that is really combining that inner journey to advance innovation. And it really is an inner journey. That's why I actually had a podcast some years ago where I called it Innervation, because it really is a marriage between what's going on as an individual to what can be done for others. And Indra really encapsulated that. And I hope you found that conversation as powerful as I did. For me, it was almost healing, this idea that we need to have confidence and celebrate what we can bring to the table of innovation. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.